Members and folks in the audience, I'm going to call this meeting to order. We don't have an official quorum in front of us yet, but I expect we shall shortly, and sure we will have one before we are ready to make any official actions. But we do have 2, 4, 5 bills on our agenda for today, so it's quite a full agenda, and we really do need to get going right away. Members, to start the committee hearing today, I guess I want to apologize for last night. As we ended the meeting, I did say on record that we would not be bringing up House File 2103 today, but that was a communications error on my part. I apologize. We were able to put out a message immediately after committee meeting on your laptops that this bill would be brought back up, and we've been able to get in touch with all of the people who wanted to testify on it yesterday who did not get a chance to, and they're back again. So hopefully all is well and we have peace in the valley, as one of our dear friends is used fond of saying. All right, so at this time, members, I'm going to bring House File 2103 back before the committee for consideration. Representative Nelson, if you would come to the testifying table. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Chair Biskins, committee members. Just a quick review. I know that some of you were, there's quite a lot of a commotion at the end of the our meeting yesterday. And I just wanted to give you a quick overview of House File 2103.
And Representative Nelson, if I can remind the committee members that we are working off of the Delete All Amendments.
Yes, thank you. Yes, DE1. And, you know, this addresses a problem, and some problems are good to have. And this is a problem that comes about from development. That's something that we all look forward to. It's something that we try to encourage in this state, and in the legislature we spend a lot of time and money trying to look at how can we encourage development. Well, House File 2103 has to do with the extra costs that are incurred with development, something that we all welcome, but yet it's a thoughtful look at who should pay for those costs. It's a way to address those additional costs. What should be borne by the developer and what should be borne by the municipality through its general fund. And the reason this is important, there's several reasons, but certainly one thing we're all concerned about is affordable housing, and we have to realize that every fee that gets tacked on to a project increases that cost and impacts affordable housing in a negative way. Basically, the bill just says that fees need to be related to the cost that the project creates. Certainly, they can't be retroactive. Payment for a fee does not waive the right to contest the fee, and certainly land dedication could be, or a fee in lieu of land dedication is a possibility, and of course it exempts the small municipalities, those who have $5,000 less in fees per year. And you'll notice, if some of you had read the original amendment, that I deleted the awarding of attorney's fees. And with that, we'll have Remy Stone give us a quick review.
Ms. Stone, welcome back to the committee. Before you give the quick review, I just want to point out Representative Winchesky. If you notice, the nameplate didn't fool Representative Nelson either. All right. Ms. Stone.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman Biskins-Dempsey. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Remy Stone. I represent the Builders Association of the Twin Cities. Thank you for allowing me to briefly talk to you again today regarding this bill. I do represent the folks who bring to you the Parade of Homes, and I'm going to do a shameless plug. We run through March 21st. Please go visit our homes. As you know, in 2001, the legislature enacted a law that required fees be fair, reasonable, and proportionate to the cost, the actual cost of the service provided. However, it's been the industry's experience that in the last 3 years, fees are still set without clear proof beforehand that there is a direct and specific link between the fees charged or the dedications exacted and the services provided. And that's precisely what we're trying to get to with this bill today. And Mr. Chairman, for the record, we need to have this discussion, and we are more than willing to discuss with the opponents methodologies to make sure that we have clear and direct essential nexus to the fees and the dedications exacted from our developments, so that olive branch is extended. Very quickly, Mr. Chair, I'd like to recap the key components of this bill that is designed to add transparency and more accountability to fee setting at the local level. First and foremost, we ask that we establish as state policy a clear nexus, i.e. the connection between a fee or dedication and the need. We want to have it put down in writing the findings that support a fee or a dedication before, not after, a fee is adopted. We want to ask for accountability for the use of the fee. We want to stop the practice of conditioning project approvals on the waiver of right to contest the fee. We'd like to establish reasonable effective dates so that we don't have problems where we have pre-sold homes between private businesses and private owners that end up being interfered with when fees are increased after the fact of those sales and the prices have been established. And finally, Mr. Chair, we would like to provide a clear methodology, very much like the county parks fee cash in lieu of bill that was passed last year. And Mr. Chair, just for the record so that everybody understands what the top five violations segment of this piece is, you'll see behind each one of those the reference to a municipality. That's just a connection to the news articles that we had submitted to the committee yesterday so that you can have a cross-reference if you're going through your materials later. But it deals with the idea of price fixing. If you raise your fees, I'll raise mine. We want to make sure that we have good due process when fees are adopted. We don't want to see interference in private contracts with effective dates that are accelerated. We do not like the idea of diversion of funds, again, taking excess surplus, whatever that may be, and divert it into the general fund or reserves. And just because fee policies where a fee policy allows you to collect a charge, even though there may not be that direct, clear nexus between the fee or dedication and the project that's being approved. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Ms. Stone. Members, we do have a quorum at this time. Representative Otto.
Would you like me to move the minutes?
that would be, if, yeah, that'd be great.
So moved.
Representative Otto moves the minutes of February 17th. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Otto, did you have a question of the testifier?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're
very
welcome,
much.
Ma'am.
I thought I'd just do you a little favor today. Okay.
you got to remember this.
yeah, you owe me one. Okay, quick question for you. I believe in fairness, and it sounds like what you're trying to get to is some sort of a fair, transparent system. I have a question for you. Has there been an increase in this type of activity since last session? That's my first question.
Sure. Mr. Chairman and Representative Otto, yes, there has. And part of it is a revenue reaction to what happened with the way the public financing happened through the state and the state's budget. But you'll see, in fact, I believe it was the Mankato article that discussed it. It was a direct reaction to those funding decisions. Yes.
Representative Otto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that. So it seems as though there's probably more fees going on, and I have a clarifying question, and I think it might have been Representative Broad, but please correct me if I'm incorrect. I believe in this committee last session we dealt with a bill that allowed for local units of government to do more fees. Am I wrong?
Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Otto, actually what we did was a clarification on the process. We didn't allow more fees to be set in any way, shape, or form. We clarified the process by which fees could be set by ordinance or by fee schedule, but in no way did that say or open up any doors in terms of setting new fees. It was a procedural clarification and change.
Okay.
Representative Otto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering because I know that, you know, as I tell my son and my husband every day, there's no such thing as a free lunch in this country or this state or this community. It just does not happen, and so there's costs. And And so things have to be paid for with revenue one way or another. And so I think we're seeing a shift in many, many more fees, and the builders are feeling it, and then they're saying, this is affecting my business. I don't, you know, so maybe there were some unintended consequences of last session that we need to revisit, because it is having an impact on this industry, obviously, because you're coming to ask for a bill with it, but also other areas that this may have occurred. And I don't know that it's wrong for cities to try to be now to find out ways to do what they were, you know, basic services they were trying to provide and things like that in a new way, because we have to be innovative and we have to be comfortable with change. So if this is the direction we're going, and this is the direction that cities have to go and communities have to go in order to pay their bills, and I don't know, I'm just throwing it out there, I guess, as a thought.
Mr. Chair, if I could just respond briefly to Representative Otto. You're absolutely correct that there's a lot of interest in trying to find alternative revenue sources to fund services that are being provided to the public. And so we're really clear. The Builders Association of the Twin Cities and my membership have never been on record saying we don't want to pay our fair share. In fact, it's the exact opposite. We want to pay our fair share. Sometimes we even agree to pay even more than our fair share, but that's where the rub is. What is that fair share or the little bit above? And the other fine balancing act that we have, we had a long internal discussion about this bill, how we should move ahead with it. Development's a really good thing, and the fees that we pay encourage communities to develop, and that's part of the lifeblood for both the communities and the builders and developers. So we don't want to harm that symbiotic relationship, if you will, but we'd like to make sure that there's a little more accountability.
Thank you very much. At this time, we're going to go on to our list of testifiers. I would like Mr. Solem from the Township Associations to come to the table. Welcome, Mr. Solem. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I am Kent Solem, representing the Minnesota Association of Townships. Before I begin testifying, I just want to point out it's not a conspiracy theory that I keep bringing a bunch of town officers with me to these hearings, but we do have our legislative conference today and tomorrow. I hope many of you can join us for breakfast over at the Kelly tomorrow for our legislative breakfast. It starts at 6:30. If you have questions, please see Gene Wooster, who's standing against the wall.
Thank you.
You probably won't see me at 6:30, but
Mr.
as far as the bill. I am going to keep my comments very brief and focus on just a few of the unintended consequences of this bill. At least I believe they are unintended based on some of my conversations with the sponsors. I'll leave a lot of the substance to the cities who have a much larger impact this bill has a much larger impact on them. The first issue I'd like to point out is introduced and it's line 11 of the copy that I have of the delete all, the term essential nexus. Fees by case law right now already have to be related directly to what is being provided. But adding this term essential nexus without defining what is meant by essential leaves a lot of room for interpretation. And I think you'll see a lot of a number of challenges brought simply trying to define what is essential. And I'm not sure that's what anybody wants to see is my private sector colleagues getting a lot more fees litigating that type of definition. The next issue that I would raise has to do with the need for finding written findings of fact to support the need for the fees or dedications. Certainly the fees need to be justified. But the debate and the discussion over how the fees are going to be set is going to be a matter of record during the public hearing, the public meeting at which the fees are being discussed. It's not totally clear with some of the other provisions of law when we have to give notice of a fee increase before we have the discussion of the fee increase, and yet we have to have written findings of fact before we can set those fees. There may be some unintended overlaps with the open meeting law that would have to be examined. I'm not 100% sure, but that's something I haven't had a chance to do the full research since getting the delete all yesterday evening. I think there is some possible conflicts in that area in terms of how do we discuss the fees and develop the written findings of fact and not violate some of the changes that were put in place in previous years. It then talks about the need for the fees to refer to the need created by the project or program. Most fees are not set by a specific project. They are set by, you know, conditional use permit fee, a variance fee. They're not a project-related fee. And I'm sure that's what the sponsors are trying to get at, but again, with the terminology the way it is, there would be room to argue and challenge fees simply because the specific fee was not related to directly to a very individual specific project or program. It's a little different with some of the dedication issues, but still it's an area of concern of those unintended consequences. The next area that I'd like to point out is on page 2, on line 23, subpart E of the amendment refers to conspicuously posted. While current law already requires the posting of notices, it's posted either on the designated bulletin board or on the door of the meeting hall. Adding that modifier conspicuously, well, I can guarantee that there are attorneys out there that are going to say, well, we didn't see it. There was paper overlapping it. It wasn't conspicuous. I know that's not the intent, but that's what we're going to see. If you don't think it's going to happen, think about all the litigation that occurred on the 60-day rule resulting in things that we never thought could possibly happen, and we had to come back last year to get those unintended consequences fixed. And it's those types of modifiers that are going to create that kind of problem. The 180-day waiting period, I understand what they're talking about in terms of some of the pre-sold homes. However, the consequence on the local government has to do with our budget cycles and when that revenue and the expected revenues and how that affects our budgeting process. And for townships, that gets to be a real big issue because our budgets are already set in March with the hopes of the revenues we're going to be receiving in the next year. And we're often working a year and a half to 2 years out. And now if we're having to delay further some of those fees after they are set, it can have some real long-term consequences for us. The last comment I have is just more of a policy question of why, and that is on page 4 where it talks about the fee not being used for existing areas or facilities. But again, when there's an increased use, when there is a change brought about by a development, there can be increased costs involved even though you're dealing with existing areas and existing facilities. And it would be nice to have some more flexibility in that area. With that, I'll conclude my comments, and I know that the cities will dive into some more of the substance of the policies.
Thank you, Mr. Sewell. I'll now ask that Mr. Tom Grundhofer please come to the testifying table. And Mr. Sewell, if you could make yourself available, we'll ask all the questions of the opponents at the same time. All right. Mr. Grundhofer, welcome. Please state your name for the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tom Grundhofer. I'm here testifying on behalf of the League of Minnesota Cities, and I really want to thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My comments will be brief because I want to leave ample opportunity for the testimony of Woodbury City Manager Barry Johnson and Attorney Kevin Ross. First, with all due respect to Representative Nelson and Ms. Stone, who testified earlier, we do not feel this legislation is needed. We feel it is unwarranted, unneeded, and it really puts cities in with little choice but to vigorously oppose it. Really, our opposition rests primarily on three grounds. First, just 2 years ago, the legislature, the 2001 legislature, dealt with a comprehensive piece of legislation dealing with exactly the same topic that we're talking about here. Specifically, that law that was being amended then and is now seeking to be amended today makes explicit now that municipal development fees must be fair, reasonable, and proportionate to the actual cost of the service for which the fee is imposed. That's what you did by legislation just 2 years ago. Additionally, just 2 years ago, another law was passed that requires local governments to report annually, April 1st annually, to the state auditor about their specific development fees, their building fees, and in fact provide justification for those particular fees. And that happens on an annual basis. First of all, I would say let's let those laws work for a while and see how they operate. Second, the number of hurdles and hoops that this bill creates for local governments is going to have one of two effects. First, it's either going to precipitate all kinds of litigation against local governments who will simply get tripped up by many of the processes and procedures that are included in this bill. Or in the alternative, cities are going to choose to basically just keep their fees so low that nobody's going to want to take the time to challenge them. Now that may have an appeal on its face, but what that really in effect does is merely transfer the cost of these developments from the general taxpayer, who will have to pay it for out of the general fund, it will transfer the cost to them rather than to the developers, who are the ones making the profits on these situations. Finally, just a third observation, which this bill deals with. It really represents an extreme level of distrust of local government officials. The type of rigor and micromanagement that local decision makers will have to go through in this bill is really, I think, dangerous and unprecedented in any kind of fee-setting situation that this legislature has dealt with before. With that, I'll stop and turn it over to Kevin Ross, an attorney with the Green Espel firm in downtown Minneapolis, who represents cities in land use matters and fee disputes. And then after Kevin will be Barry Johnson, who's the city manager in Woodbury.
Mr. Ross, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the tape.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Kevin Ross, and I'm here partnering with the League of Minnesota Cities. I work in a private law firm and find my time lately consumed with this particular provision, at least in its present state. And so I was asked by the League to come in and share my perspective on what the language is likely to result in terms of real impact later on. And so there's two questions, I guess, that I came to that I hopefully will answer today. One is, are there problems identified by the proponents of this particular legislation that are not already adequately addressed in the current law? And secondly, even if that's the case, even if it's true that there may be anomalies or issues that aren't currently appropriately addressed, is the fix appropriately stated in this particular legislation? That is this the right fix? I will, to be direct and then detailed, first say that the answer to these questions are pretty clear to me. I do believe that the issues that were raised as the motivating factors to this legislation are already addressed in the current law. Also, assuming that there are issues that may still need to be addressed or that may be particularized issues in different locations in isolated fashion, is this the right fix? And my answer there, in looking at the language, would be no. My bottom line assessment on this is that I have no real question in my mind that if this legislation is passed as it is currently stated, it will result in more bureaucratic local tape, it will result in more litigation, I'm quite certain of that, and it will actually end up in more cost to local taxpayers. And as I look at the legislation and try to get a sense of the way I've seen things play out, I think probably ironically, the inadvertent consequence is that there will be an increase to development corporations as well in the cost that they pay. I'm sure that was not intentional, but I think that's the case, and I'll explain why. Just to highlight the testimony that I'll give under the particulars, as to the second question, does this seem like the right fix? I think there are buried landmines in the language of the proposed legislation from a litigation standpoint and from practical application standpoint. One, I think you're going to have, as I mentioned, new bureaucratic processes at multiple stages. You're going to have new prohibition against waivers. That is, you're going to be in court more simply by nature of opening doors that are currently, at least you have the option of closing those doors if you're a municipality, so you're definitely going to have more lawsuits. You have a new, and I would suggest to you, a radically new standard of judicial review that is embedded in the language that I'll discuss with you. And regarding a matter that was brought up a moment ago by the counties, I believe you have new restriction in park planning that perhaps was not intended, but I think it is significant. Now, in looking at the first question, does the current law, the law as it is right now, that you're considering amending, does it already provide an adequate fix for the concerns that were raised? And I appreciate the comments by the proponents of this legislation, and it certainly is something that I've heard before, developers saying, you know, we're just fine with paying our fair share, we just want to make sure that our share is fair. That's an adequate concern, but I think the challenges that were raised to whether they're paying the fair share don't necessarily play out with support in the actual cases and circumstances, even the ones that were cited yesterday that I'll also refer to. Historically, development should pay for itself. Some cities do a good job. Some cities have, frankly, done a terrible job at trying to get development to pay for itself. Why is that important? It's just a matter of fairness. You don't want to have a homeowner pay for development for the individual's own home and then pay for development for the new homeowner and then the next development project and the next one down the line. Historically, developers, because they're the ones reaping the largest profit, should pay a fair share of development, and they share that cost usually with the ultimate homeowner because developers naturally want to pass through some of that cost to the end user. So they kind of share in that cost, and I think every one of us agree that's a fair way to manage. The new rules that were put in place, just as Mr. Grunhofer said, just 2 years ago, were designed to address certain concerns that were presently raised in this, presented as support for the new legislation. There are four components to this, and I'll say again, new legislation. It's just been in place for 2 years. It's a very short shelf life for municipalities trying to put the processes in place to respond to the concerns that were raised. Requirement number one actually already was in the law. That is, the fees have to be by ordinance. Number two, the fees have to be fair, reasonable, and proportionate to the actual cost of the services that the cities are providing. Bear this in mind. We're not talking about fees for the sake of fees. We have to consider that cities actually provide real services, and these services come often at a very substantial cost to the city. So we're talking about fees that are designed to recover as much as possible, as much as reasonable for those particular cost items. The law also requires management and accounting to make sure that there's this supposedly a new concern, but it was there in 2001 and it's addressed in the current law, that is an accounting to make sure that the fees are actually being used for the purpose, the connection, the nexus for which they are collected, and that final component, just to make sure, the concern about accountability, there's a requirement in the statute now that there has to be an annual accounting, matching the cost to the fees to make sure that you don't have the gouging that is accused by the proponents of this legislation. Now, there's been some discussion of the fact that fees have gone up. That shouldn't be a great surprise when you think about how historically the new legislation has now played out. Again, just 3 years ago, new legislation passed requiring cities to do an accounting, figure it out, tell us, are your costs and fees really matching up? Cities went through and did the math, and what they did is in their review of their existing fee schedules, which are, you can imagine, old, very antiquated fees, they figured out that, you know, we haven't looked at this in quite some time. Now we have to. And they did. And what did they find, by and large? They aren't charging enough to recover the cost of the services that they're providing. So they instituted new fee schedules. And yes, often those fee schedules resulted in an increase. But it's not intended to be a landfall or a windfall for cities. I had a chance, since Ms. Stone testified yesterday, I hadn't seen this Elk River news article, but it certainly piqued my attention when she used it as support for this legislation, indicating that there is a surplus in the city of Elk River as a result of its building and permit fees in 2003. So I gave Elk River a call, and I would encourage each of you to do so before passing this on to the for full consideration. As it turns out, didn't surprise me, this language in the article, there wasn't, in fact, a revenue over budget. But the article doesn't address costs. And if you call the folks in Elk River, you'll find out that they haven't done the accounting yet. It's not yet required until June to be completed. The accounting required by statute to match the costs to the fees. But the city did do its accounting for the previous year, and as it turns out, that accounting is a matter of record. In Elk River, the costs, same building costs, same the building and permit charges, matched up. So to use this as support for this notion that there's a profit is certainly a misunderstanding of the way cities do their accounting. This is just the revenue side. There's another side of the ledger sheet. It's costs. It's not considered in the article. And if you want to get a fuller picture, you should talk to the folks at Elk River about that. So the accounting issue, I think, is adequately covered in the current law, and that, I think, is why you have these increases. Now, let me turn...
Mr. Ross, yes. If you could wrap it up. We've got a big agenda today, all right, and a number of testifiers.
All right.
So
I'll go as quickly as I can through what
Thank
I see
you,
to be the landmines. I understand that there's a limited amount of time. I will give you the headlines and allow for as much questioning and detail as you'd like. The bureaucratic process. I've had a chance to speak with individuals who do this kind of accounting. Ms. Stone mentioned, well, we're just talking about mere fact-finding. That's all. The fact-finding that we're talking about will be substantive and detailed because of the language that requires this need, the necessity for this particular fee, the apportionment between the amount of the cost that should be attributed to the developer as opposed to the taxpayer, and on top of that, you have this language of direct and essential that's already been alluded to. And you'll see if you look at the case law, when you have that kind of loaded language, direct and essential, you're going to be requiring accountants to do a substantial amount of work in order to present the city councils with the information to do the kind of fact-finding necessary to stand up in a court of law. What you ultimately will have is about 200 hours worth of service for the smaller cities. Private accountants will do that work. Local governments don't have the resources to manage that. The prohibition against waivers is significant. Currently in the law, cities are allowed to ask for a waiver of challenge to fees and the cost provisions later on. The Supreme Court has said that's a good thing. Two years ago, the legislature considered and rejected exactly that provision, the refusal to allow cities, the prohibition to allow cities to hinge a decision based upon whether or not there is a waiver of liability. And I suggest to you that it would be a bad idea to open up the floodgates to lawsuit by rolling that back. The standard of judicial review, I've already mentioned the essential nexus and the direct nexus language. For lack of time, I won't go into that, but that is enormous as a matter of law. As far as park dedication, I've talked to our city planning folks after I saw this particular legislation, and in fact, what happens under the current law is that there's a presumption that cities do need parks and therefore can dedicate a certain amount of land or ask for money to pay for park services, and what they use the money for often is to rehabilitate older parks in the area to accommodate the new development without necessarily adding a new park. And as has been stated by the counties, that is a big concern in this legislation. It seems to close that door. The bottom line is, I think, in the end, cities are going to try to protect themselves in this legislation, avoiding the lawsuits by saying, you know what we're going to do? If we're going to be open to more litigation because of the anti-waiver provision, if we're going to be open to more lawsuits and we're going to have this detailed accounting and respond with the kind of procedures that are required in order to cover and protect ourselves, we're going to ask outside engineers to do the engineering and inspection work. And it's going to cost developers a lot more in the long run than is suggested by, I think, the intention of the law. So in the end, I think what happens here is you have increased cost to developers, increased cost to the taxpayer, and the harms that are suggested as the concerns are already addressed in the current legislation, which I think adequately has adequately has accounted for the accounting issue, addressed the relationship issue that is a concern, and it has not yet played out and should.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ross. If you could stand close by until we're done with testimony for potential questions. Last testifier that I have on the list, Mr. Johnson. Please, welcome. Please state your name for the tape.
My name is Barry Johnson. I'm the Woodbury City Administrator. Mr. Ross has done an excellent job of covering the general issues with this bill. I'd like to focus on a number of specific things from the standpoint of someone who may have to implement these provisions. First, in the section regarding findings of fact, I'm troubled by language that makes us consider whether the fee is necessary, not from the standpoint of the substance, but what does that mean? Does that mean this is a last resort, that it's only necessary if we can't raise taxes or fund the activity from some other source? This is one example, I think, of the areas of potential litigation that Mr. Ross referred to. I have to point out the administrative burden that comes with the requirement to justify every fee. Woodbury has approximately 150 separate charges. These may be related to different values of building, etc., but related to official controls. The necessity to justify and prove the charge in each and every one of those cases, as well as to show that we are providing each of those services in a cost-effective manner, will be a substantial burden. And I'll tell you, as the administrator of a city that has probably the most extensive performance measurement program in the state, where our council uses over 130 statistical measures of efficiency and effectiveness, that proving cost-effectiveness is an extremely difficult thing to do. That database basically is not out there. The 180-day notice provision, as was mentioned before, is extremely unreasonable. 180 days before the start of a budget year, we would not even have a proposed budget for that next year. How can we adopt a fee to implement a budget that doesn't even exist? The alternative is you delay the adoption of that fee, and then you can't implement it until halfway through your next budget year. The section in regard to prohibition on a condition that a developer challenged a fee, it seems to me that this mixes two levels of proof required of cities. The first part of the legislation asks us to justify fees in general. This section seems to say that the application of a fee to any given development also is subject to challenge. Well, the fact is fees are set on averages. And so if we are open to challenge on every fee that some developer may believe is beyond his cost, in essence what we're saying is that no one above an average can be charged, only those below average. We become a sort of anti-Lake Wobegon, where every developer is below average. The ability to challenge those fees also has no sunset. I mean, it could go on forever. It, in theory, could be years after the development. These previous speakers have talked about the potential unintended consequences of this legislation, and I'd point out one that I think is real and goes a lot farther than they have suggested, and that is to answer the question, why would a city want development under these kinds of conditions, where you are subject to legal challenge, where you cannot potentially cover your costs? Cities already in a situation like ours see that our roads are congested by new development, our schools are overcrowded by new development, and now we are faced with our taxes having to go up as a further result of that new development. If you're sitting on a city council and you are considering whether to open new areas for development, why would you do it under those conditions? And I would suggest that more and more communities will choose not to do it. And I think that this is going to have unintended consequences that even the Builders Association would find unacceptable. The section on dedications is perhaps one of the most troubling in this legislation. First, the language requires that the dedication of land be necessary as a result of approval of that subdivision. Well, the fact is that when you put in a park, it serves not just that particular subdivision, but a whole surrounding area. And proving that that extent of dedication is required only by that subdivision is, in many cases, not going to be possible. Some subdivisions are required to dedicate land. Some subdivisions are required to provide a fee in lieu. But all are treated, we believe, equally. And yet there's a special burden as a result of this language on showing that the land dedication for a development is required just by that subdivision. The most troubling part of the dedication section, however, is language that says we must consider areas and facilities reserved for the subdivision. First of all, I suggest that wording is ambiguous, what does it mean to consider? I would suggest that the clear intent is what we have to look at, and the clear intent is that you not only consider it, but you take some action based on that consideration, and that the action that is contemplated here is you reduce their dedications in some way related to the facilities they provide. Just as an example, in Woodbury, in the last development area that we opened of about 1,400 acres, 950 of those 1,400 acres are occupied by three large developments. The remaining land is scattered around those, not in any particularly contiguous way. Each of those three developments are putting in very extensive private facilities with swimming pools and other kinds of recreational amenities. They are not doing this for the purpose of lowering the burden on the municipality. They're doing it as a marketing tool for their developments. But this would say that we have to reduce our dedications because they choose to do this. This will significantly impair our ability to provide parks for the remainder of this development area. The loss of the fee revenue, the loss of the land, makes it very hard in our case to provide adequate park systems for the remainder of the scattered parcels in these areas. In essence, what we're doing is laying a basis for these major developments to secede from the city for park purposes. I think philosophically that should be unacceptable, and I can tell you that we would find it unacceptable from a city standpoint. And I would go back to the question of why would a city accept this? And I suggest that in our case we're not likely to, and one consequence is we probably will prohibit these kinds of PUDs in the future from having these private facilities if it's going to damage the public park system. Those are a few of the comments I have. I think there are other issues buried in this legislation, as Mr. Ross has said. I think this legislation should not be passed, and I would ask the committee's consideration of that course. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Questions from members of the committee? Representative Braun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question goes back a ways in the testimony, but I think it was Mr. Grunhofer and Mr. Ross both that spoke, and I appreciate your words. You talked about the current law that fees must be fair, reasonable, and proportionate to the actual cost of the service for which the fee is imposed. And I think I heard you say that that is right and just. Now, how do you square that with the statement that's made in one of the handouts that we got that, plain and simple, this is a revenue reaction to the state? How do you square the justness of the fair and reasonableness of fees to the reaction of state funding in terms of a city budget?
Well, Mr. Ross.
Yeah, I would suggest that without regard to the response or the motive of any one local official, there is still a requirement at law that it be fair, reasonable, and proportionate, and the accounting provision, regardless of an individual's motive, saying, "Well, we're going to, you know, hope for more revenue so that we can cover for costs that or cover for amounts that we otherwise would not get in terms of state money." There's still an accounting that requires cities to actually show that their actual costs, match up to the fees. And so the law, I think, already safeguards that concern. I hope I've been responsive to your question.
Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chen. I appreciate that. But when you have cities out there saying that we're raising fees as a reaction to budgetary reasons, it goes against the fair and reasonableness of what's currently in law. And that's, I think, what causes questions and what puts things into question as to whether we're really following actually current law and do we need to tighten up that law.
Mr. Ross.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's a fair question. However, the current law still requires that the basis for the fee be the cost. Regardless of any individual elected official's comment to the contrary, whatever the individual motive might be for raising the fee, you still have to have the support in the cost. And so what I found is that cities who've gone back and they've done this math and they've tried to get a sense of what are our actual costs, what does it cost us to provide this service, this inspection service, this review service. What they've seen is that they haven't adequately covered that cost before, so they're raising their fees to match it. Now, it may be that this raising of fees covers an area that otherwise would be chargeable to the state or to the general tax base, but it doesn't change the fact that it still has to be covered by the actual cost.
Representative Nelson.
Yes, I think Representative Broad really came right to the head of the whole bill. And the point of this bill is that there needs to be a connection, a nexus between the fee that is charged and the cost that the development brings to the city or to the municipality. And with all due respect, I think Mr. Johnson actually made the case for me. And that is specifically in his comments about how 180 days are impossible to live with as far as setting these fees because the budgets aren't even in place then. And that's the whole point. The fees have nothing to do with the budgets of the cities. The fees need to be tied to the cost of the development that is being brought to the municipalities. So I don't think the fees are a budget, something that makes the budget of the city. The fees should be tied to the cost that the cities incur from the development. So they're very separate issues.
Representative Ellison.
Mr. Chair, this is a question for anybody, including Representative Nelson. How might this bill, if enacted, affect local property taxes?
Representative Nelson.
I don't know that it would affect local property taxes. I guess it depends on what the municipalities do. But if you're implying that costs that are...
I'm not implying, I'm asking.
Well, okay, if you're wondering if costs that currently are being given to the developers because they need to... recoup costs that are not maybe tied to that specific development, then would be passed on to property tax holders. I guess I would maintain that if the costs are incurred by the development, they should be paid by the developer. If not, they do need to be paid in some other way.
Do the other testifiers have views?
I think Mr. Johnson has a view on this.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, it's my belief that in two ways property taxes would go up as a result of this. The first would be, as I indicated, and it may be Representative Nelson's intent that, in fact, each individual development should not have to pay more than its cost. But the reality is that when you put together a city budget, which is your statement of your cost to provide services for the coming year, you have to look at your estimate of what it takes to provide a service in total to all development. Now, if you are then subsequently going to be second-guessed when that general fee is applied to any given development, what it means is you will end up in individual cases having to reduce your fees, meaning you will reduce the charges that you budgeted for, and that will have to be made up in some way. Secondly, I believe that the provisions in regard to dedication will force cities, if they continue to provide parks for these, I'll call them remaindered areas outside of these major PUDs, to do it without the revenues from these major PUDs. We struggle to provide park systems now based on park dedication fees. The only way to do it without those resources coming in will be raising taxes.
Representative Ellison.
Another question I had has to do with the state charges fees for a whole range of things, and they're not necessarily tied to the cost of providing a particular service. In particular, if you get a DUI and you want to get your license reinstated, you got to pay about $680. That's not in any way associated with that, with the service of the processing of that fee. Wouldn't this bill essentially be telling municipalities, do as we say, but don't do as we do?
Representative Nelson.
Well, I can say that I do think there's more than $680 of costs incurred by our societies by a DUI. They may not be directly involved in getting the license back, but those costs certainly have been put upon our society.
Mr. Chair, if I could just correct you, Representative, you have fees paid at the judge assesses fines, the judge requires restitution. I mean, the fees are covered. This is for license reinstatement, not covering the costs of what a driver may do. And that's just one example. I'm not here to debate DUI policy with you. I could use another example. But the fact is, as a state, fees are routinely charged on any range of things the state wants to charge fees on, and they're not necessarily related to the cost of the service that the state is providing. And yet we're restricting the right of local government to charge fees as it deems appropriate. Am I accurate? Or, I mean, you might not agree, but I mean, what do you have to say to that?
Well, I think there's
end of Nelson.
Thank you, Chair Biskins. I think we're missing the point of this legislation, and the point of this legislation is simply to work off of what was passed in 2001, and the nexus piece is what is missing here. Is there a connection between the development and the fees? And that's all it is. It appears that the intent of the legislature was to include that there would be a nexus, and that it talked about fair, appropriate, and I forgot the other adjective right now, proportionate fees. And this is just clarifying that it's fees that are tied, it's costs that are tied to the development. And I would like to just take this opportunity to say that you know, I'm actually very disappointed that not a single one of these people talked to me until 1 o'clock yesterday. And usually I think it's much more advantageous to work out issues in your office, because quite frankly, I have marked, in listening to the debate, I have marked three things that I think are deserving of further discussion. But had they been brought up at an appropriate time, it may have been easier to work on those issues. Specifically, the word necessary, I think, may have something that needs to be worked on, as well as the sunset for the right to waive the fees. I think that is a legitimate concern, and I think we need some clarification on the areas that are considered. And I would, my intent there is that it would be areas such as wetlands and that type of thing. So I do think there is some areas that need to be addressed, and with that in mind, I would ask the chair to lay this over, and I would look forward to working with the opponents and come to an agreement. I think the intent of this bill is basically that it's not a slush fund for a city, basically. And so there needs to be some connection, and we cannot ask developers to fund things that are city issues and that are greater than their share of the development. And I think that's the bottom line. It's an issue of fairness, and I would look forward to working on some of those issues that I described.
And the chair respects the will of the author. House file 2103 as amended is being laid over. Thank you. Next bill on our agenda today, members, is House file 1855. Representative Cornish, are you in the room? Representative Cornish.
I was feeling real good here, Demps. They were calling me.
Hey, I addressed you correctly, Mark. I addressed you correctly.
Chair.
I saw that. Representative Lanning, would you kindly move the bill, please?
So moved.
The bill has been moved, and we will begin the testimony. Representative Carnish, would you state your name for the record, and then begin the begin your testimony, please. And then, if you have any additional testifiers, we'll take them after yours. Is that all right, Representative?
Mr. Chairman, yes, sir. Okay. That's fine with me.
Representative Carnish.
I'm Representative Carnish, and Mr. Chairman and members, thanks for having me here today. I'm going to give you a short layman's term explanation of House File 1855. What you have before you there in your packet is a short bill. It's basically a definition change, but by that definition change, you will, if passed and goes to the floor, you will be allowing a county simply to get in on the same process that a township or a city now enjoy. This bill has to do with hazardous buildings and hazardous property. Right now, the county hasn't got equal footing with cities and townships in the way that hazardous property or hazardous buildings are dealt with. This does not usurp the township or city's power. It is simply a inclusion of a county into the definition of municipality. Instead of saying city or town or township, it will say municipality, and then county will be included in it. And as I said, by this definition change, now a county will be able to enjoy the same process that the city or township has in dealing with this problem of hazardous property or hazardous buildings within the county. It'll be a lot less cumbersome and less expensive so that the county can join in this process. So with that, I've got Mr. Dave Wyrens from the Counties Association of Minnesota Counties, and Colleen Landkammer, who is the chairman of the Blue Earth County Board of Commissioners, and Verl Morrell, who is the Planning and Zoning Administrator. Holds a number of titles, but he'll get it right when he gets up here. So I'll turn it over to Mr. Wyrens first, and he can go through the bill for you.
Mr. Wyrens, would you kindly state your name for the record and then begin your testimony, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is David Wyrens with the Association of Minnesota Counties. And with that very good preview by Representative Cornish, I don't have a great deal more to say. He summarized the bill and what the intention is. This was an issue that has been brought to the association to pursue as a legislative change. The idea here is to give counties an additional tool to deal with what are termed hazardous buildings and property. And I think more commonly what we think of as kind of the junk property that's here on the countryside, a dilapidated building, property that has old vehicles or appliances out in the yard, to deal with those kinds of circumstances. And the idea here, again, is not to change the process, not to change the actual authority, but to extend it solely to counties. I have had a conversation with the League of Minnesota Cities and Minnesota Association of Townships, and there is no opposition or concern that I'm aware of under this bill. It simply is, again, an additional tool for counties to deal with these sorts of properties. The basic idea here, before I turn it over to Commissioner Landkammer, is to make sure that counties have a process to ensure that private citizens remain responsible for their own property and don't push those costs onto the public sector. That's the basic idea here. And this authority will provide counties with that particular opportunity. At that, Mr. Chair, I would end my comments and turn over to Commissioner Landkammer.
Okay. Are there any members for the question? Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize. I guess I just have, I support the concept. I support what you're doing, but I do see
I have a question, and it's about overlapping jurisdictions. Right now, we give the authority to the town. We give the authority to the city. We do not have overlapping jurisdictions in those two cases, all right? And so at that point, a decision made in the city, right, can't be overlapped or can't be usurped by anyone because no one else has jurisdiction. But I'm looking at the case where, you know, Fred thinks that Bob's shed is a hazardous building and goes to the town board and says, I want you to remove that eyesore because I want to look over the horizon over yonder, all right? And the town board says, that isn't a hazardous building. We don't have to remove that. And so he doesn't like that answer. Now he has the ability to go, if this were to become law, to go to the county and say, you know, you've got the authority. Would you remove Fred's hazardous building for me? Yeah, and again, that's way out, all right? But this potentiality has to exist when you have overlapping jurisdictions and there is no prevention of that written into the law. Or am I wrong? I stand to be corrected.
Mr. Chair and first, I think the idea, I think your issue raises one that's a common one between authorities, between counties, cities, and townships. And it's no different here. I guess down to the relationship that local governments have. But I think a better answer is from Mr. Morrell, who would deal with these circumstances on a regular basis and give, I think, a more complete answer of how that kind of circumstance might operate out in the real world.
Mr. Morrell, would you kindly state your name and then answer the question by Representative Viskins, please?
Absolutely. Thank you, sir. My name is Verl, David Morrell, and I'm with Blue Earth County Environmental Services. I am the Land Use Administrator. I am in charge of the Land Use Division of Environmental Services. I have been involved in several of these hazardous building abatements for our small cities in Blue Earth County that don't have the kind of staffing, the expertise to go out and do these types of investigations themselves. They'll call up to the county office and complain about a building in their city, ask what they could get for assistance. In those instances, I've gone down to four smaller cities in our county, Mapleton, Pemberton, Amboy, and Vernon Center, and I've done approximately three to probably five buildings in each one of those cities for them, where I'll come in at their request, go in, do an assessment on the building, write up the report, all of the photo documentation that's necessary, work with their city attorney to prepare the cases for abatement, and then offer to testify in court for them on their behalf if needs be. And I've also worked with a couple of the townships in the county to do the same thing. Unfortunately, the same luxury, if you want to call it that, or the tool that we have that the cities and the townships can use, the county cannot. And I guess I can't speak for my county board, but my experience with the county is that I don't do anything without a request for assistance from the township to start with. So to answer your question, if somebody went to the township and the township said no, I wouldn't get involved as long as the township said no. The different abatements that I have been involved in are those where we have been requested direct assistance from the city or from the township.
Yeah. All right, are there any other questions? All right, next will be Commissioner Landkamer. Would you kindly state your name for the record and then begin your testimony?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Colleen Landkamer. I'm the chair of the Blue Earth County Board of Commissioners. Mr. Morrell has given most of my testimony at this point, actually. I just want to clarify again. Blue Earth County staff has worked with cities and townships in the county of Blue Earth to help mitigate hazardous buildings, and they've been able to do that under MS Chapter 463.15. Unfortunately, the same statutes that work in cities and townships, counties can't do. You know, county boards are charged with making wise use of public funds. Blue Earth County has expended large sums of public money bringing civil actions and injunctions under county ordinances and other statutes, such as MS-145A, commonly known as the public nuisance law. That's the option we have. It's much more expensive. The hazardous building abatement statute provides a much more precise definition of what constitutes a hazardous building, and it also is much easier. We don't have to go to tax forfeiture before we can proceed. Blue Earth County has experienced many common tax forfeiture problems. One owner of a rundown rental properties has frequently tax forfeited properties rather than investing money needed to restore the properties to a reasonable condition. Often the buildings split off from property and the tax forfeited parcel is worthless. It's land that's too small to build on, and it doesn't have enough room for septic systems or anything like that. So what it costs to clean the property up usually is much more than what we can get in a tax forfeiture sale. This bill would give counties the same ability as cities and townships in order to deal with those issues.
Thank you. Are there any questions from the members? Representative Lanning renews his motion that House File 1855 be recommended to pass be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register. Is that motion clear? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Motion carries, and the bill is passed. Thank you, Representative Cornish, for your presentation.
Thank you.
You know, Mr. Chair, Representative Cornish forgot to bring in his freshman treat. First time before the committee, and he forgot to bring in his freshman treat.
Representative Cornish, did you hear the remarks?
I was here last year with an NRA.
Doesn't count. That was last year. <You're the freshman.
laughs> All right. Moving on. Next will be House File 1843, Representative Queasley. Representative, would you come and Representative Broad, would you kindly move House File 1843?
I will move House File 1843 recommended to pass and to the general register.
The general register. Very good. Okay. Representative Queasley, kindly state your name to the committee. Welcome to the committee, and then begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bill Queasley, representative from the Rochester area, actually High Forest Township, but we don't get that technical around here. This bill was brought to me by a township officer actually down just north of Rochester, Randy Dimmer's district. I used to have it until redistricting last year. Basically, audits are now required for any city or town over 2,500 and that have revenues over 500,000. This hasn't been adjusted since 1992. And so what the bill does is go back to 1992 and use inflationary increases to bring it up to 670,500 and then from here forward to increase it by the rate of inflation. So these towns at least can have a benchmark to go by where they are not having to do all this extra paperwork of doing audits, which is quite expensive. I think the intent of the legislature when they set it at 500,000 was to review this once in a while and not just have a hard ceiling. This bill tries to do this. I worked with Ms. Dyson to come up with some kind of formula for it, and I think this addresses some of the concerns. I don't know of any opposition to the bill. It's pretty straightforward.
Okay. Are there any questions from the members? Representative Otto?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to speak in support of the bill. I have the same issue in my communities, the real small communities, and they're trying to find ways to save money, and yet they're still being held accountable. You know, it's not. So I appreciate the bill. I just want to speak in support of it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, once in a while we go around here and say, you know, how can we cut paperwork for local units of government? And sometimes they come forward with good ideas. Hopefully this is one of them.
Very good. Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Quisley, so you've got an escalator here from here on out. Why didn't we have an escalator before?
Representative Quisley.
Mr. Chair, at the time, I'm not sure of the history. I wasn't here in 92. I think there was just an attempt to, at the time to do some auditing of larger cities, although it was over 2,500. This also includes townships. And they said it as just a floor. I suppose they just figured in future legislators, people would look at it and see if it needed to be done to inflation. At the time, they probably weren't even thinking about whether or not there should be an inflationary index on it. You could also look at the, you know, the 2,500 population, but that because we have cities in the state going up and down population, you could argue that that is probably something that should stay put. But it seems like the cost of government is going up constantly for local units of government, and this is one way to allow them to save some costs in auditing.
Representative Mariani, follow up.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Quisley. So these are for annual financial audits, and these are done by the local municipalities, or are these contracted out into the private sector?
Representative Quisley.
Mr. Chair and Representative Mariani, almost all of these are contracted out where they hire somebody from outside of the township or city. I don't know of any township officer or anybody that would be able to do these audits. It's I think I was quoted around $2,000 to actually do some of these audits, and it goes up depending on how complicated their bookkeeping system is. So it's somewhat of an expense to the townships and small cities.
And Mr.
Representative Chair, Mariani.
And Mr. Quisley, and I am empathetic, but, you know, when you said the cost of government, that's why I asked that question, because it looks like it's really the cost of the private sector in terms of what the going rates are out there to charge. And so I think, you know, as we, you know, present this to the public, you know, that we're going to raise these caps and then put an escalator, that we need to recognize that what we're doing is responding to market forces out there, not necessarily to, you know, government forces that, you know, and these become, I mean, I'm not trying to play the game. I mean, these really become kind of big, you know, kind of schism discussions when we get into the political arena, you know, that things are costing more because government costs more. Well, in this case, things are costing more because the private sector in the marketplace is saying this is the going rate. And but I absolutely support your bill here, and we'll vote for it.
Are there any other? Do you have a response, Representative Quisley?
Mr. Chair, I kind of tied it to the price indicators that I did. The price of government is one of those things that it's hard to gauge from local unit of government to local unit of government what their actual inflationary increases are. Some have a higher rate of increases, and some do not. So this was just an attempt to find something to tie it to.
Are there any other questions from the members? Seeing none, Representative Broad renews her motion that House File 1843 be recommended to pass and be placed on the General Register. Is there any question? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Motion carries. Thank you, Representative Quisley. The next on the agenda will be House File 1883. And Representative Klinzing, if you would move the bill. Excuse me. I will have Representative Mariani. Okay? Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move House File 1883 be recommended to pass, and this is going to the floor. Is that right, Senator Rukavina?
I think so.
That's correct.
Okay.
It will go on the General Register. Is that understood? Okay. Representative Rucavina, would you kindly state your name for the record and then begin your testimony, please, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Tom Rucavina, a pleasure to be here. Thank you, Representative Mariani and Mr. Chair. What this bill does, I got a call from the mayor in the city of McKinley, one of the small cities in my district. Of course, you know, with recent budget cuts, they were looking at ways to save money. And one of the things they thought about doing was combining their clerk and treasurer position. But because of in statute, they're a Plan A statutory city, and by combining the clerk and treasurer's position, Minnesota statutes kicked in 412.02 subdivision 3 and 412.591 subdivision 2, which required an audit if their budget exceeded $100,000 a year. It was something they didn't have to do before. The audit was estimated to be anywhere from $5,000 to $6,000 a year, which would have negated the combination of the clerk treasurer's position. So they asked me if it would be possible to up the $100,000 limit in statute, which my understanding is probably about the same year as Representative Queasley just mentioned for his. And so the bill would raise that amount to $150,000 and then tie it to the implicit price deflator starting in 2005. It would be adjusted for that in the following years and just go up gradually.
And Representative Rucavina, that will be an automatic increase. Am I correct on that?
I would assume so, Mr. Chair. I don't know if the implicit price deflator has gone down in any of the years I've been here. We tie some other taxes to that, also in statute.
Okay. Do you have anyone else that would want to testify on behalf of the bill?
Mr. Chair, I've learned a lot. Long time ago in my life, shorter is better. Both personally, physically, and politically.
Are there any questions of the members? Any questions? Seeing none. Representative Rucavina, Representative Mariani renews his motion that House File 1883 be recommended to pass and be placed on the General Register. You all understand the question. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Motion carries. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
That was a short agenda.
Representative Broad, would you kindly welcome to the committee? And I appreciate the fact that you are a member of the committee. So, Representative Biskins, if you would move House File 1691.
Mr. Chair, I'd be glad to if Representative Broad wouldn't want to move her own bill.
I would be happy to move it, but I will defer to one of my senior members.
Very good. Okay. Would you kindly state your name for the record and then begin your testimony, please?
Laura Broad, State Representative, District 25A. House File 1691 essentially does two things. It clarifies language in the statute and amends a law that requires a unit of government to make a final payment on a small road contract. Essentially, this is trying to align the language within the statute within the subdivision so that there is a clear so that it's actually clear and aligned. What we're trying to do is make sure that a township officer or a township does not have to go out and issue a final payment after every snowfall or after every time they grade a road. We're trying to exempt those things. The other thing the bill does, it has a repealer, which essentially enables the town clerk to be held liable for the action of the board. I have Kent Sulem with me here today with the Minnesota Township Association to talk again with any technical clarifications in the bill.
Okay. And Mr. Sulem, would you kindly state your name for the record and then begin your testimony, please?
I
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Again, my name is Ken Sewell. I'm representing the Minnesota Association of Townships. And after 2 days of having to oppose bills, it's nice to be here in support of legislation. And for the record, we also, even though they weren't our bills, we did support the two bills you just passed for Representative Quigley and Representative Rukavina. Representative Broad did a nice job of summarizing what this bill, I know a lot of people thought it sounded more complex than it really is. In subdivisions 1 and subdivision 2 of 160.17, the phrases used are road construction or improvement contract. In subdivision 3, those modifiers, for reasons nobody seems can tell us, disappeared and it just said road contract. When read literally, that means that these certificates of completion, which are simply internal documents, they're not anything from an outside source, they're internal paperwork, have to be done every time we go out and do snow plowing, every time we put down a small piece of gravel, those types of minor maintenance work, even though everything else in the statute refers to these, the major road improvement and construction contracts, you're going to have multiple phases and you're going to have the engineers involved. And so the rules, the change simply makes the terminology consistent throughout the statute. And as said, it keeps some of the clerks who are still here today out of jail when they don't have a right to vote and the actions of the board says, you shall pay the bill, and they go to jail for paying the bill they're told to pay. So that's simply what the bill does. I understand that, that there is still some discussion about English grammar on it. I think it works with the grammar as drafted, but I know that has been discussed, but I urge your support for this legislation.
Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Broad.
Thank you. One extra thing. I just want to make a note that this bill does not change any of the uniform municipal contracting provisions, so I just want to make that clear.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Mariani.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Broad, I'm wondering if maybe we should amend your bill to perhaps add a clemency provision for all those all those good people that have been jailed over the last 3 years as a result of
I believe that we're looking into those things okay. At the current time.
Are there any other questions from the members? Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Broad, what is the threshold at which a sealed bid is required?
Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe it's contracts over $35,000 for municipalities of less than 2,500 population and contracts over $50,000, if I'm correct, for populations over, is it 5,000?
Over 2,500.
Over 2,500. And that does not change.
Representative Biskins, a follow-up?
Well, just so that I have this understanding right, so Representative Broad, the intent is that this piece of legislation not affect any work under 35,000 for towns of 2,500 or less. Is that correct?
Representative Broad?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, no, I don't think that's correct. It's essentially those are the communities who are outside of the bidding, and so this wouldn't apply to them. So, in fact, you're right. I'm sorry. Yep.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Biskins.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Sulam, is that statement consistent with the other subdivisions in Section 1, or is this now going... Yeah, I understand the intent of putting in road construction or improvement to become consistent with the other subdivisions. Are we now, by adding that statement, becoming inconsistent again?
Mr. Sulem?
Mr. Chair, Representative Biskins, no. The reference to sealed bids is also contained in Sub 1 and Sub 2.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Adelson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Broder, Mr. Sulem, if this is a, I don't know if this is a crisis situation right now. It seemed to me we're in the middle of a heavy winter and we're plowing like crazy. Does this legislation need an enactment date other than August 1st?
Representative Broad. Representative, you want to yield?
Yes, I'll have Kent Sulem talk about that piece in terms of the township's wishes.
Okay. Mr. Sulem, would you respond, please?
Mr. Chair, Representative Adelson, when we discuss an enactment date, in reality, with the rush of the snow plowing and everything that's going on, most communities are not currently actively getting these internal documents anyhow. It certainly is not going to hurt us to have, you know, to clarify that the fact that they're not happening, it certainly would not hurt us to have an immediate enactment date. I don't know that it's going to hurt us not to have it.
Representative Adelson?
Follow up.
Okay. Are there any other questions from the members? Representative Biskin renews his motion that House File 1691 be recommended to pass and placed on the general register.
So was Representative Braun. Her motion, Jerry.
Pardon?
Mark Sorensen.
I think that, to be quite frank with you, Representative Abrams, I think I goofed that up a little bit, to be quite frank with you. So I apologize, Representative Broad. Okay, it's your bill, and I should have let you move the bill. I hope you forgive me for that error.
Absolutely, Mr. Okay. Chair. And I also just wanted to, in regards to Representative Adelson, I do have a Monopoly game and have some get-out-of-jail-free cards.
All right, are we ready to vote? All those in favor? Signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. The motion carried. Thank you very much. We stand adjourned.